I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Student debt has been climbing in recent decades and today stands at $1.5 trillion. That's more than the cost of credit card debt. Some 44 million people are saddled with this debt, which averages about $30,000 at graduation. Here in Pennsylvania, the average student debt is closer to $36,000, which means the state leads the nation for the amount of student debt, followed closely by Delaware and New Jersey. A recent poll by Politico Harvard School of Public Health found that there was broad bipartisan public support for, quote, finding ways to lessen student debt. About 10% of borrowers default on their student loans, which some have called a moral failing. But a new report just out yesterday from the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Inspector General blames the department's student loan unit for not monitoring loan servicing companies that have mismanaged student loans. Well, today on Radio Times, what's driving the cost of higher education? Who are these 44 million people? How does their debt affect their career and life choices and the overall economy? And what about these loan servicers and what can be done to tackle this problem? We have three guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studio is Sarah Goldrick-Robb, and she's professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, also founder of the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice in Philadelphia. Sarah Goldrick-Robb, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, and she's a reporter for the Washington Post who covers student debt, joining us by telephone. Danielle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests and joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Seth Frotman. He's the founder and executive director of the Student Borrower Protection Center, former student loan ombudsman of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He quit in protest over the bureau's policies last fall. And Seth Frotman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have a lot to talk about during this hour. And let me just start with the fact that student debt has topped $1.5 trillion. And Sarah, since you're sitting across from me, what is driving student debt?
Well, what's really driving student debt are two things. First, people want to go to college, and that doesn't mean necessarily they want a liberal arts degree. They want to go and they want to get a skill. They want to learn a trade. They want to be able to get a job that creates some stability in their lives. And then the second thing is we haven't created a financing system that makes that possible without student debt. And so as a result, their desire to get an education is translating into a massive financial burden.
And we see the colleges. I mean, I remember when I went to college, it was a couple of $1,000s. It was, you know, back in the dark ages. But nonetheless, today it's thousands and thousands of dollars, even for in-state tuition.
That's right. I mean, in the past, far fewer people went to college and the government did more to help pay for it. We're in a situation now where the risk of getting a higher education has been shifted from the sort of public provision of education to the private paying for education. And so today's students are bearing a much greater share of the cost of paying for college than folks like yourself did in the past.
Danielle, let me get you in on the conversation. You cover student debt for the Washington Post. What are your thoughts about just what is driving the student debt in this country?
I think to piggyback off of what Sarah said, there's certainly a greater interest in attending college than in previous decades. But there's also another trend that's making a huge impact for particularly state universities, is that a long history of state disinvestment. There have been some instances in the last few years where states are starting to reinvest, but it's not enough to change the trend that's been going on for the last maybe 20 or so years. And what that's meant is that schools have raised tuition to offset the amount of money that they're no longer receiving from states. And as a result, students are bearing more of the burden of having to pay for their school. So whereas you would have seen the state in a lot of instances back in like the 80s or even the 70s cover about 70% of the cost of going to college. That's no longer the case. And unfortunately, the federal financial system, which includes Pell Grants and student loans and such, hasn't quite kept pace, especially in the Pell Grant piece. And that's a really important piece for a lot of low-income students. The purchase power of the Pell Grant just is no longer what it used to be in the face of really increased tuition costs as well as housing costs.
And that certainly happened here in Pennsylvania. Seth Rotman, let me get you in on the conversation. We're talking about 44 million people. What do we need to know about these people who are saddled with this student debt?
Well, there's a common misperception that that this is some sort of young person avocado toast eating issue where it's just a bunch of millennials who have too much personal haven't taken enough personal responsibility. But nothing could be further from the truth. Student debt is an intergenerational issue. We've seen student loan borrowers, the fastest growing segment, actually being borrowers over the age of 50.
Wow.
It's an urban-rural issue. White borrowers, borrowers of color. So one of the most important things, I think, to help drive the conversation is to put away these like tired notions that somehow this is just one segment of the society or one segment of the economy.
And so, I mean, broadly speaking, obviously, a lot of people, if we're talking about 44 million
Guys,
people,
the
Seth.
Echo on my thing is so horrible.
Are we okay there? I'm Seth. Are you all right? Okay. All right. Just wanted to make sure we're all still hooked up there. But so let me go back to you then, Sarah. So broadly speaking, we're talking about women, right? Women over the age of 40, as I understand it, probably lower income, maybe minority, largely minority women. Is that who we're talking about?
I mean, as Seth said, it's an incredibly diverse group. And that's because people from all walks of life have tried to get an education. You know, there certainly are folks, though, like you're mentioning, who have perhaps tried college maybe 15, 20 years ago when they were very young and are now coming back in their late 30s, early 40s, maybe even their 50s to try to finish a degree. And they're having to take on a lot of debt to do that. And one of the things that is really sad is that a lot of them are coming back motivated by trying to do right by their kids. So maybe, you know, these are moms who, when they had young children, they didn't go to college. They raised their children. Now their kids are done with that. And they're trying to come back so they can have a career. They have 20, 30 years left in the workforce. But in order to finish those degrees, they're having to take on, you know, a substantial amount of debt.
Seth, do we still have you? We still have Seth? Okay. I wanted to find out why though, is Pennsylvania number one in the nation when it comes to student debt?
So I think to echo Sarah's point earlier before, I think what you've seen in this country is a lack of investment and a serious disinvestment in higher education. And this really picked up around the recession, where state lawmakers were struggling to try to fill their tax coffers in the middle of the crisis. And they looked around and they were trying to figure out, you know, what can be cut. And unfortunately, the story of Pennsylvania cuts across the nation, which is where they looked across the budgets, and they centered on higher education as a place to kind of balance their budgets, with this notion, which I think is terribly wrong, that somehow families could fill in the gap, that you could just pass the cost, ever-increasing cost of tuition on the back of families. The problem with that was this was at the same exact moment where families were really struggling. They lost their job, lost their savings, lost value on their house. So what quickly became kind of something where the state was investing a significant portion in higher education got shifted onto the backs of families and then very quickly onto the backs of individuals in the form of increasing student debt. And in many states, including the state of Pennsylvania, we have not dug out from that problem.
Well, in fact, Daniel, let me toss this to you. I was reading that 2/3 of college students in Pennsylvania borrowed to pay for their education, and the graduates of Penn State, Temple University, and Lincoln University among the highest debt in the country, just to underscore what we're talking about. Danielle, why do you see Pennsylvania as an outlier? Why is Pennsylvania an outlier?
I think, much like Seth said, Pennsylvania certainly has not gotten over the severe cuts by former governors, including Tom Corbett. And those cuts, even if you were to try to reverse them at this stage, that money would not be enough to make up for what the universities lost. And universities feel that in order to continue to operate at the level that produces the kind of excellent students and graduates that Pennsylvania has, they have to increase the rate of tuition. And as a result of that, you have this situation. I mean, Pennsylvania, in terms of the borrowing at 60%, it pretty much tracks with the national average. There are an increased number of students who have to borrow. And it's not always at certain very large amounts, but certainly there are at least 40% of the student borrowing population has at least $10,000 worth of debt. Now, if you were getting a job that could sustain with sustainable wages to try to cover that debt, that's one thing. But if you're seeing folks that are not necessarily finding employment right out of school that can cover and help them repay that debt, that's a problem. And the other issue is that there are a lot of students who are not completing their degrees. So without the degrees of which they started to try to obtain, they're not going to find the job that's going to help them repay that debt. So that's another piece of the pie.
Sarah, you teach at Temple University, so what do the students tell you?
The students are going through a lot right now. I mean, the truth is that, you know, Temple, I know people around the country think Temple's a private institution, and it's not. It is the public university of the city of Philadelphia. And if you know Philadelphia, you know our economy is actually not in great shape and that even our middle-class families often struggle. We also know that childhood hunger is, for example, rising in this city.
It's the largest poor city in the country.
Exactly. And in the face of that, we have an institution that has received less and less support from the state over time, while increasingly having students come who need college, but also have serious financial needs and they need support. They need more money per student to make graduation possible, and they're getting less. And, you know, to top it off, consider the fact that Temple University is not a place that wealthy donors tend to give money. So one of the ways that institutions can keep tuition down and give a lot of financial aid is when they have a big endowment, right? Bloomberg just gave this massive amount of money to Johns Hopkins that dwarfs the size of even Temple's entire endowment. We have a half of $1 billion. The University of Michigan, another public institution, just raised $5 billion in a single campaign. So we are under-resourced, yet we are accessible, and we're doing our best in a really tough situation, and frankly, our students are struggling.
Well, and we're almost having a break here, but what I hear you saying is that we are telling young people, go to college if you want to improve your life, if you want to get a better job, go to college, but then saddling them with debt because college is more and more unaffordable.
Those are different people doing that too, right? Parents are right to want their people to go to college, to get their children to go to college. The government is not backing them, and that's the real challenge.
And that is Sarah Goldrick-Robb from Temple University. Also with us, Danielle Douglas-Gabriel. She is a reporter for The Washington Post who covers student debt. And also from Washington, D.C., joining us, Seth Frotman. He's the founder and executive director of the Student Borrower Protection Center. And we're talking about the fact that student debt has doubled in the last decade, standing at about $1.5 trillion. That really is unsustainable. We'll be talking about what to do about it. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with our guest today on the show about student debt. And it is climbing and has been climbing in the last couple of decades. And again, talking with Seth Frotman, Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, and Sarah Goldrick-Robb about how we got into this situation. We'll be talking about what possible things we can do to get out of it. Danielle, let me go back to you and just go back to what happened yesterday. I'm looking at your headline in the Washington Post, Watchdog Blasts Education Department for Sloppy Oversight of Loan Servicing Contractors. Can you boil down what happened yesterday for our listeners?
Sure. So the Inspector General for the Education Department released this pretty scathing audit of how the department oversees its contractors. So the department pays about 9 different companies, including the one that's based in your neck of the woods, SEIA, to oversee how the collection and application of student loans. Now, these so-called student loan servicers are supposed to help guide borrowers through the most affordable payment plan. They're also supposed to kind of help them avoid default, essentially. And the Inspector General said, well, you know, despite the fact that the department found continuous incidences of these student loan servicers breaking the rules or not doing their job, they're rarely ever punished. And that sends a horrible message to them that they can act without any sort of impunity. And what's worse is that the department wasn't making any effort to have them reimburse the money that the department has been paying them in instances where they're breaking the rules as per their contract. Now, the department has been pushing back on this, and it's not surprising because for the longest time, I think Seth's former agency, while he was there, made a very good effort of trying to push the department to do more to oversee these contractors. And there's always been this tension there that the department feels, well, we're doing the best we can. A lot of this is a misunderstanding of how servicing works. And so they've never really been kind of listening to consumer complaints about this. So having the IG say this in great detail, I think, puts a fine point on what a lot of student advocacy groups have said, what Seth said at the CFPB, in a way that we hadn't seen before. So it's really an important piece added to this conversation.
Which is why I want to get you, Seth, back in on the conversation. I can hear you there. And we're talking about Navient, the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency, one also called Great Lakes. Fill in what Danielle was just saying so that our listeners understand what's really at stake here.
Absolutely. So there's actually two sides of the student debt crisis. The just sheer amount of student debt, the unprecedented balances that we have forced an entire generation to take on, which Sarah talked about so eloquently before. Unfortunately, the other side of the student debt crisis is the rampant illegal practices and fundamental lack of oversight that is in place for those 40 million plus student loan borrowers. What we like to say is this is the portion that adds insult to injury for tens of millions of borrowers. Not only do they have a ton of student debt, but there's also a cottage industry of players out there who view the $1.5 trillion in student debt as their chance to make a quick buck. And
I mean, we're talking, and just, I'm looking here just at my notes here. So we're talking about, in some cases, steering students to or graduates to predatory loans, overcharging borrowers, misrepresenting loans. I just want to make sure our listeners, Seth, understand really specifically what we're talking about here.
Exactly. So as Danielle mentioned, student loan servicers are companies that get paid hundreds of millions of dollars to help borrowers with the rights and protections that they have, that Congress has passed. But what we have seen, what law enforcement officials throughout the country, including the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, have alleged is that from the moment a student loan borrower gets her first bill until she pays off that debt, they are getting runaround, lost information, and too often practices which could add thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars to their bills. And I think yesterday's report is probably the most damning, but in a long line of audits and investigations that have shown that the student loan servicing industry is essentially one built around a business model that denies borrowers their rights.
Is that illegal, as the law stands now, Seth?
Yes.
Yes.
It is absolutely.
Okay,
and
just checking.
I think one of the interesting things and one of the reasons why I'm so excited to be on is in many ways the student debt crisis runs through the state of Pennsylvania. Nearly $800 billion of student debt for nearly 20 million borrowers in America is actually serviced within the Commonwealth.
Wow.
And I think that there is a unique obligation and responsibility, especially when it comes to the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Authority, because they currently service $425 billion of student debt. And yesterday's report demonstrates the significant problems that borrowers have with that company.
And this report, Sarah, named names. I mean, it didn't hold back on who they were talking about.
No, it didn't. There's no reason to. I mean, we know who's doing these things. I mean, at least what they're accused of. And students don't, however, I want to point out, know about this. So they don't know who's at fault. They just know they're getting the runaround.
Right. And the runaround meaning, and I read a number of stories about being given wrong information and it took years to correct information, things like predatory loans, which, of course, we know what happens when you get caught up in that system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing to remember is that a lot of the people who have this debt didn't get college degrees. Right. So some of these folks and it really these are the ones who are in the most trouble, honestly. They got a year or maybe two of a college education. And the fact is that even with these loans, the college prices were still too high to afford. And so they were still left, for example, without even enough money to pay for their books, their supplies, to have housing. And so they left without a college degree. And being in that situation, if you can imagine, where you tried to go to school, it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You dropped out with debt and no degree, and now you're being given a runaround by the servicer? You can imagine how aggravating and disconcerting this is for people.
And Danielle, just to make sure our listeners understand, someone with this level of student debt, they can't declare bankruptcy, right? They are really stuck with the rest of their life paying all this debt.
It is exceedingly rare that you could ever get student loans discharged in bankruptcy court. So essentially, yes, it is the albatross that will remain around your neck. And that's, I mean, the interesting thing is that the last couple of administrations have tried ways to make student loans more affordable, at least in the monthly repayment. There are countless income-driven repayment plans and new iterations of these things that peg how much you pay a month based upon your income, and it fluctuates based upon your income.
Right.
The trouble is they're exceedingly complex, and most people aren't paying attention to all the fine print in these agreements, and as a result, they remain very confused. And you will hear from servicers, and I've spoken to a lot of servicers who say that they're often feeling a little confused about all the various plans that are out there. At least they feel like they could be simplified to make it easier for them to counsel borrowers on which one would be best suited for their particular needs. That's not to excuse the behavior, and oftentimes it is sometimes just laziness. I mean, you have instances of consumers saying they're being steered into a forbearance of a temporary postponement of their payments because that person on the phone didn't have the time or want to spend the time to tell them about all of the different plans they could probably be eligible for that would help them. And that's a breakdown in the system, and it starts at the top, and that's the Department of Education.
Well, Seth, here's a silly or sort of basic question. Why is it so complicated?
So it's so complicated because with the ever-increasing amount of student debt, Congress has stepped in, to Danielle's point, and the number one response at the federal level has been trying to ensure that borrowers have an affordable monthly payment. That has been kind of the central premise of what has come out of Washington to kind of deal with the student debt crisis. So there is an ever-increasing amount of options that are trying to help borrowers essentially make it through the month. The problem we've seen is that these are very, very powerful tools. So these quote-unquote payments could be as little as $0 if you lose your job or you suddenly lose your income, but you could still be in good standing. Despite these protections that exist, we continue to see a million student loan borrowers default each and every year. And this is why servicing is so important, because these are the companies that are supposed to ensure that struggling borrowers get into those protections. And just to go back to yesterday's report, one of the most damning stats is in over 90% of the monthly reports that the EdIG looked at, the servicer did not sufficiently inform borrowers about available repayment options in at least one instance.
90%. Wow.
In 90% of the reports, there were instances where the servicer did not tell the borrower about all of their options. And this is why this is so critical, because borrowers have rights and protections that are guaranteed to them under federal law. But the companies that are getting paid hundreds of millions of dollars to do so are asleep at the switch, and the Department of Education is doing nothing to hold them accountable.
Let me read some comments here. One from Joanna on our Facebook page. I spent about 2 hours yesterday trying to dig my way through understanding the various payment plans and the loan forgiveness plans. I'm more confused now than ever before, just underscoring what we were talking about. Also, an email from Allison. I'm 23 years old and I just graduated from Temple University 2 years ago. I don't know if I'll ever see a student debt-free life. Often people from older generations will suggest that college students my age simply work their way through college to avoid debt, but it's not feasible, especially with the increasing emphasis on things like internships. I worked full-time in the service industry while being a full-time student, and I'm still drowning in debt. And I have to say, Sarah, you are vigorously nodding your head there. You've heard this before.
I have, and I've heard it from my 69 undergraduates at Temple, who I'm teaching right now, on the very first day of class in a class exercise. I wanted to get to know them, and I asked them to stand up and array themselves based on how many hours a week they work. And I found that first, two-thirds of my class were employed by very start of the term. And I was looking at that one-third that wasn't employed. And I said to them, you know, there are people out there who would say to you, why are you taking loans? Why aren't you just, you know, working your way through college? What's with you? And so I said, let's dissect this. How many of you are searching for work and unable to find work? And it was more than half of the people who were not employed at the moment.
So
and that's the other piece.
They need to work.
They need to work because they're subject to this current economy where there are other people out there who are not in college and don't have complicated class schedules. The employers do not view these students as optimal students, employees of choice. And frankly, the minimum wage doesn't even pay very well. So these folks really need to be able to both work and borrow in order to get this done, which means, and I think this is the real crisis, they're entering into these loans. They're taking this debt without it being of their free choice. You know, I mean, college does not feel like a choice anymore. It feels non-optional. And with prices being this high, including in the public sector, what choice do people have?
Let me read a tweet.
The problem.
Yeah. Go, Daniel, let me just read a tweet from Representative Brendan Boyle from Philadelphia. And he says at $1.4 trillion, although it might be $1.5 trillion, in total student debt, loan debt, it's a ticking time bomb to our economy. We must address it now before it does to our economy what the real estate bubble did in the last decade. But, Daniel, let me give you a chance to respond with what you were going to say, but also what is, if anything, is happening in Congress to deal with this, as Brendan Boyle says, this ticking time bomb?
So actually, I was going to mention there seems to be a disconnect in Washington among policymakers between what Sarah sees as the reality on the ground, which is the case across the country. There are students working as way more than they probably should as they're trying to get a college degree, whether they are part-time or full-time. And yet still you have lawmakers saying, well, if you just work your way through college the way I did back in 1970-something, then you wouldn't have to worry about taking on this debt. So that conversation needs to consistently be had in order to get people on the same page about what we actually have to deal with in order to make this college more affordable and more accessible for students. What we're seeing right now, and you know, there's the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. Now, this is the law that governs every aspect of higher education, especially the financing piece. Senator Lamar Alexander, who's the chair of the Senate Education Committee, has said that he would like to try to get the reauthorization done before he retires next year. So there's hope there that as a result of that, we'll start to see some movement on plans to simplify some of the repayment plans, simplify some of the loans and grant structure that the federal government has. But there has to be real conversations about what students actually need and how federal and state authorities can actually make sure that they can attend school, focus on their studies without having to constantly worry and be fearful of how they're going to pay for it after the fact.
Seth, can you talk about the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program?
Sure. So I think just one point I want to make in response to Sarah, who is obviously 100% spot on, is one of the things I wanted to highlight is some of this, I don't know how else to say, kind of this fake personal responsibility narrative also extends out into repayment, where there's these notions that is totally incorrect, that is somehow there's a generation of student loan borrowers who are somehow just walking away, just absconding from their debt. Based on my experience, based on the tens of thousands of complaints I read, nothing could be further from the truth. And that's why the AIG report matters. It's that people are desperately trying to pay back their debt. They're desperately trying to get into the protections to give them some financial lifeline, but they're trapped in this incredibly broken, rigged system and can't actually do that because of servicers. And that is a perfect segue into the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which is a promise the federal government made to people who are willing to give back to their communities. So teachers, nurses, service members, you name it. If essentially we're told around a decade ago that if you worked and gave back to this country and this community, we would forgive your debt after 10 years. Hmm. Unfortunately, what we see is that due to mismanagement by the Department of Education and rampant illegal servicing breakdowns, that promise has been broken for potentially millions of Americans. The first eligible cohort of people are applying, and we've seen 99% default rates.
99% default rates?
I mean, denial rates. 99%.
Thank you.
Sorry, 99% denial rates.
Meaning rejecting 99% of those people who are applying to this program.
Right. So not only are they rejecting 99% of people who are applying for the program, in many ways, I think that might only be the tip of the iceberg, because when we hear from borrowers, what I think there's also a lot of people out there who, you know, 5 years into repayment realize that, you know, their servicer lied to them at some point over that time frame, and they aren't halfway towards forgiveness. They're actually, you know, at square one and will probably never apply and will never realize the extent to which this system failed them.
Well, let's take a very short break. Danielle, I'm sorry we have to say goodbye to you, but thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And that's Danielle Douglas-Gabriel. She's a reporter for The Washington Post who covers student debt. We will carry on our conversation. Much more to talk about related to student debt. Sarah Goldrick-Robb from Temple University. Seth Frotman, who is the founder of the Student Borrower Protection Center. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me just recap here. Student loan debt has more than doubled in the last decade to $1.5 trillion. And behind that gigantic number are something like 44 million Americans. Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey rank 1, 2, and 3 for the highest student loan debt in the nation. We are talking about all of this with Seth Frotman. He's the founder and executive director of the Student Borrower Protection Center, also a former student loan ombudsman for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He actually quit last fall in protest over policy differences. Sarah Goldrick-Robb with us here in our Philadelphia studio, professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, founder of the Hope Center for College Community and Justice in Philadelphia. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sarah, you wanted to talk about this higher ed bill and what's happening in Congress as you see it.
Yeah, I think there's a real disconnect, as was mentioned earlier, between the realities that students are facing and what policymakers are thinking as the solution. You know, two things have happened in the last month. First, on January 9th, the U.S. Government Accountability Office released the first ever report indicating that high numbers of college students are dealing with food insecurity. Okay, students don't even have enough food to eat. And yet, at the same time, we're seeing a discussion from the Department of Education about how students are taking too much in terms of loans and wasting the money. that they should be cracking down on that. And then we also have this conversation led by Senator Lamar Alexander, who says that his big solution and his big proposal for the Higher Education Act is to essentially shorten the form that mm-hmm. people use to file for financial aid. Now, I think we can all agree that taking a lot of time to fill out that form is super annoying and no family wants to do it. But also, let's be honest, that all these borrowers already did that. Nobody's accessing these loans without doing the FAFSA. So,
and that's what it's called, FAFSA.
It's called the FAFSA. And so I call it the small American bureaucratic tragedy, frankly. But, you know, the fact is that we're going to simplify the FAFSA. It isn't going to make it actually more affordable for any of these current folks. And it is actually possible, and it's so sad to say this now, that the FAFSA is an invitation to debt.
Oh.
You get in, you get a Pell Grant that used to cover 100% of college and now covers barely a third in the public sector at four-year institutions. And now you have access to debt that still isn't even enough money to make sure that you can eat. I mean, something's really wrong here.
Well, Seth, let me go back to you. There's so many things that I want to make sure that we talk about, and I'm watching the clock here trying to slow time up for our conversation. I'm not apparently able to do that, but there are a number of people running for president, I should say. They happen to be Democrats, and some are talking about free college education. If we're talking about this problem, and it seems like we're not at the solution part of dealing with this problem, is that a way out?
So one of the things that I learned traveling the country for the last 3 years talking to people about student loan and student debt is I think it boils down to this. You can make college free tomorrow mm-hmm. and it would do nothing for the 45 million people that we are talking about. And I think one of the real disconnects here is when you hear elected officials, when you hear people on the campaign talking about the issue of student debt, you know, usually there is proposals around college affordability and free college. I could tell you firsthand there is nothing that irritates or makes someone with student debt more upset than to be told the answer is to make college more the solution to their problem is to make college more affordable for the next guy.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So I think I think that the answer is we need to have these two conversations in parallel. Obviously, I've seen firsthand the impact student debt is having on individuals and larger economics and society. So I think proposals around college affordability and decreasing student debt on the front end are critically important. I didn't want to come off too flippant about that.
Sure.
But we need to build into the conversation what we are doing to help people who have this historic debt. Because it's not only about them, right? We're seeing the impact on their individual household finances from buying a house, saving for retirement, family formation. But there are huge questions, and we're starting to see data about how debt-fueled higher education is driving income inequality, racial inequality, economic and geographic segregation. So I think this all needs to be on the table. And I think to Sarah's point is that it seems as if the technocratic solutions that we're hearing coming out of Washington are just wholly disconnected from what you actually hear when you talk to real people.
Well, let me just underscore what you were just saying there, Seth, because if someone is getting out of college, let's say they either got that college degree or they didn't, but nonetheless they have this debt, so that's going to delay whether they buy a house. Maybe it's going to delay whether they get married and have children. That might delay if they're going to save for retirement. So it seems like all these personal decisions have a larger national economic impact.
So the only thing that I would say is I think this is, to Sarah's point, who's much more eloquent than I am on this, I don't think these are personal decisions. I think this is the system that we created. We're forcing hundreds of thousands of people every year to make the least worst decision, which is take on a ton of debt to try to you know, keep their head above water in the American economy. So I just think that we have to be really careful about how we talk about this, because mm-hmm. The people we talk to and the people I think we all know don't view whether or not they're going to take on student debt to try to get an advanced degree as some sort of decision. It is a binary factor about whether or not they are going to actually go to college.
So, Sarah, should we forgive this debt? I mean, I understand why free college doesn't address what it is we've been talking about. But so what do we do about the fact that people are saddled with thousands and thousands of dollars of student debt?
Well, I think this is one area where Seth and I have a little bit of a different perspective. So, you know, the fact is that I actually think the idea that current borrowers, people with debt, say, don't help people avoid debt in the future until you take care of me, is the outcome of an incredibly divisive system that was not created by ordinary people. Okay, if we take a step back here and we think about what's really happened, you have people fighting over education, right? And the way that we should be able to get it. And, you know, think about this in the context of a family, right? I was at the Chicago Housing Authority this week, and I talked to people who, you know, for example, a mom who's 37 years old and has student debt also has a 17-year-old, right, in her house. And the saddest thing is for that mom to look at that child and say, I'm not sure I should send him to college because I'm struggling with this debt and I'm not sure college is good. That's not a good situation. Now, I want to be really clear. Even if we can't clear that mom of her debt, mm-hmm. her 17-year-old benefits from free college. And the wonderful thing is that in Chicago, they're working really hard to make the City Colleges of Chicago free for those folks. And the odds are better for that family if that 17-year-old can get that education. There's no question about that. So I think
meanwhile, we've got the mom.
We absolutely do have the mom, and we do need to have solutions. And I think that there are discussions about a full-scale jubilee, right, where there's broad just forgiveness across the board. I'll tell you the forgiveness that I support first. The forgiveness that I think needs to happen ASAP is the forgiveness of debt for former Pell Grant recipients, because the country has betrayed these people. When we started this program in the 1970s, the decision was that we would fund fully college for those folks because they are low income and we know they have no ability to pay. They weren't supposed to have to take any debt. Now, 90% of students who were Pell recipients in the public sector have debt if they actually get a degree. Yeah. We need to help those people, and that's a targeted forgiveness. Next thing we need to deal with are the people in the middle class. And frankly, they have been hurt because they can't qualify for the Pell Grant, but who are we kidding? They can't afford the prices. But I just want to be clear that it is a national shame if we take the fact that they have debt and use it as an excuse or do damage to making things affordable in the future. We would have gotten nowhere in the 20th century if we'd said, look, I paid for high school. You should go through the pain, too, until my pain is gone and now we won't make high school free. Making high school free was a critical decision of the 20th century.
And I just want to chime in.
Yeah, go ahead, Seth.
If I was inartful, I think Sarah and I actually agree. I think the way to try to solve this is not to pit one group against each other. Because I think what has happened in the past, whenever we try to look for money in the system or try to do kind of higher ed reform, we end up kind of pitting one group against another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the strongest advocates for college affordability, free college on the front end, are actually the generation of people who have seen their financial lives potentially ruined because of that debt. So I just want to be crystal clear. I think the answer is not picking and choosing amongst people with debt versus, you know, my kids or your kids. I think it is realizing that the coalition to actually end the $1 trillion experiment in debt-fueled higher education mm-hmm. is by building that coalition together.
Agreed. Well, and I was even reading about people old enough to receive Social Security also having some money taken out of their checks because they're still trying to pay off their student loans.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, Seth, something I was reading about. I don't know how common it is, but I was reading about a couple of employers or companies where the employers actually help their employees pay off student loans. I don't know if this is a giant trend that's happening or whether it's just some very benevolent employers that want to help out their employees. But is that something we should think about?
So, you know, one of the things that I always like to say is, you know, when you have $1.5, almost $1.6 trillion, there is no silver bullet. Mm-hmm. So I think programs like employers trying to help their borrowers pay off debt is a net positive. The first response you always hear is, but this isn't going towards the people who are really struggling. Mm-hmm. And I think that gets at a fundamental problem in this discussion, where in my mind, I think the fierce defenders of the status quo are defining who is struggling way too narrow. So in the discussions in D.C., when we talk about who we should be helping and who is hurting, there is a very kind of quaint definition of whether or not you are just behind on your payments or in default, which, you know, by the way, total somewhere around 14 million people. Mm-hmm. But there are a whole lot of people who are making their student loan payments who are struggling with other facets of their lives, from buying a house to saving for retirement to, you know, even what careers they could enter into. So I think programs that help borrowers, even if they're, you know, middle income, alleviate some of their burdens of their student debt, are beneficial and help them kind of achieve a lot of the American dream where they feel held back.
I noticed that your former boss, Seth, talked about the moral failure or failings of people that are unable or are not paying back their student loans. I'm giving you a chance to respond.
Well, so I think one of the most frustrating things for the year where I tried to stay on at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, because, you know, I thought this work was important, was the fundamental lack of seriousness in which folks like Mick Mulvaney took the job. This was a person responsible for overseeing trillions of dollars of consumer debt, including, you know, the $1.5 trillion of student loan debt. And if there was any effort to read, you know, a handful of the student loan complaints that we had received, or to look at some of the findings in some of our law enforcement work, you would realize that just the opposite is happening, which is people have been forced to take on this debt to achieve any of the benefits of higher education in this society. You know, and Sarah talked about the risks of not, but then they are forced with trying to pay this back amongst predatory companies and a broken student loan system. And rather than pontificating about other people's lives, you know, I think there should have been actual seriousness of focus to help them.
Let me read an email from Brennan. I'm a Temple student who is finally graduating after attending on and off for about 10 years, having to work full time to support myself while being unable to pay for tuition other than the debt has resulted in $46,000 in student loan debt. I'm not looking forward to making the student loan payments once I graduate. I wonder if I would have been better off not going to college at all. And I mean, obviously, Sarah, we can't decide for this individual person, but it does raise the question about whether we are over-promising people about a college education.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the saddest thing, is that the price and the financial situation people are finding themselves in is making them wonder if education was worth it, as if we're supposed to decide if education's important based on the price of it, right? As if that was good for this country. You know, what he's dealing with is totally normal. It is exactly how many of my students are they're raising those questions in class right now. But the fact is, the reason people are going is because there really isn't an alternative pathway. And that's not to say you have to get a bachelor's degree. I mean, I want to be really clear, because I hear from people all the time who say they should just go to technical school. They should get a vocational degree. Folks, we're talking about vocational here.
Exactly.
We're talking about debt from going to community college now. And if somebody would like to design a different system that gets people access to the middle class and stability in their lives that doesn't run through some additional education after high school, and they want to design that as a debt-free pathway, by all means, design it. Try it out with your own children. Make sure it works for them before you start trying to sell that to the people who, frankly, are going to be left really vulnerable if they don't get what they need right now. You know, what you just said about the moral failings, I want to point out, this has been said of low-income moms with children, then it was said of Pell Grant recipients, and now it's being said of the middle class for borrowing money to go to college. I mean, this is all of a piece.
Well, as I said, I'm trying to stop time during this hour so we could continue our conversation. I couldn't do that. Sarah Goldrick-Robb, thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
And Seth Frotman, thank you for joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can do that through iTunes or through NPR One. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.